Simon Hunt, consultant in the global economy, China, and the copper industry. Welcome to the Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, pleasure to be on your show.
So, Simon, you and I have spoken a lot before about the copper industry and about the way that it is truly a barometer for the world economy. You've taken I believe you wrote it as the stupid step possibly of forecasting out copper demand and pricing for the next 8 years. What do you see that the copper price and demand picture have to tell us about the health of the world economy over the next 8 to 10 years here?
That is a huge, huge question. Because to answer it, we have to talk about how we see the global economy performing, not just this year or next year, but as you've said, out to 2032. So let's have a look at that before we start talking about copper, because copper is integral to business activity. The global economy is slowing and will continue to slow into the early months of next year. We then have the possibility of two scenarios playing out. The first is that central banks and governments will pour everything into the system to kick the can down the road once more. So that's starting around the middle of next year, we will see economic recovery, but it will be stagflation, which means that inflation rises faster than GDP growth. So, rising inflation means rising 10-year plus interest rates. Under this scenario, we are going to see probably double-digit inflation by the end of 2027. Not only in the U United States, but globally. So, what does that mean for 10-year treasuries plus? The bond vigilantes will give the game away by demanding a positive return on their assets, which means that 10-year treasuries will be at least 10%. What is that going to do to a highly indebted system? We have a mega crash. The second scenario is that the slowing economy, that global economy that we are now seeing, and that includes China, will persist and turn into recession into 2028. Followed by a systemic crash. I'm not sure which of the two scenarios play out. One thing, though, will be sure, and that is in both scenarios, we will get rising inflation, which, from a stock market point of view, even in the second scenario, equity prices will outperform GDP growth because everybody will be looking for hedges to rising inflation and a falling US dollar. For instance, we have the DXY, which is now around about 100, actually falling by the end of 2028, 2029 to close to 50. So even if physical consumption in either in both scenarios is pretty weak, that weakness will be taken up by the financial community buying physical copper and futures as one of their hedges against rising inflation and a falling dollar. This has been the historic pattern. It probably will be an even bigger one in this period. How much will they buy? I would say plus 500,000 tons a year. So it's the financial community rather than the physical trade that's actually going to tell you what prices do. So that's the simple macro background to copper. So what does that mean to prices? I don't have my price forecasts in front of me at the moment, but the general trend is that prices this year and next year, the rest of this year and next year, will fall to around $7,000 from the current figure of 10,006. And then, under both scenarios, we get rising prices, which will be around $14,000 by the end of 2027, early 2028. That's the simple copper story. But what it also means is that with the cost of money rising and with the economic conditions basically deteriorating over the next couple of years, from the very optimistic views being expressed by the media and so many analysts, all those forecasts on data centers are not going to prove out to be correct. So, take it back even further. It means that electricity consumption is not going to be what it's being made out to be. So the whole of that artificial intelligence and data center bubble is going to burst.
Well, I mean, there's so much there that is a complex web as well. You and I, before we hit record here today, we're talking about the way that profits are being recycled between all of those companies, and yet it doesn't seem like the market understands that or is pricing it in any way, shape, or form either.
I don't know whether your comment understands is correct. I think more likely don't want to know.
It's like the
It's
horse with the blinders on.
it's part of the bullish syndrome. You don't want to know the other side of the story. That was certainly my experience in the 1970s nickel boom.
Because is it that hubris and that investor psychology that when you're making money, you feel indestructible and like this?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Simon, what types of cycles are also coalescing in the next decade that serve as a major headwind to the world economy, the US economy, and many of the things that we just touched on?
That's a very good question because in such a fractured world, economically, financially, and geopolitically, conventional linear forecasting is a waste of time. So we went back and looked at, in fact, I have been for many years following a number of cycles. And the interesting thing is that the cycles that I follow converge on this 2026 to 2028 period where you're going to see business activity and financial markets having possibly the last peak next year, followed by 6 years of falling business activity and prices. This is a chart drawn 150 years ago. The interesting thing is that it shows clearly 2026 is a peak year. Some moment next year, equity prices will peak, business activity will peak, and it's followed by 6 years of falling equity prices and falling business activity. There are a number of other private cycle experts that we use, and they're more or less telling us the same story, which basically means conventional forecasting is probably going to be proven wrong. So the basic message is we have got very volatile years ahead of us, and you don't want to be the last guy on the dance floor when the music stops. Because when it stops, it's going to be very sudden, and the cause of the music stopping is really unknown. It can be a financial issue. It's more likely, in my view, to be a geopolitical one. And I would not be at all surprised if Israel plus America does not strike Iran next year, which would drive oil prices probably above $150. And what does that do to a global economy, inflation, interest rates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? But I think the important thing that we should bear in mind is the global picture, because incidents like Venezuela, Nigeria, Iran, Ukraine are all part of this bigger picture, which is the battle going on between America's led unilateral world and the BRICS-led multilateral world. It's unlikely at the moment, anyway, that Washington will be prepared to compromise enough to join the multilateral world. So I think geopolitically, we are going to continue to see friction. The war in Ukraine will get worse before it gets better. Iran will be hit. America is trying to, did try to wrest Russia away from China and failed. They are trying to wrest Brazil out of BRICS. They are trying to wrest China away from Russia. None of these attempts will succeed because the alliance has got so deep within the big BRICS members, and that they continue to plan away from using the dollar in a very planned manner. So, if you consider the size of BRICS, it's growing probably twice as fast as G7. And we don't yet know what their new currency will be, but what we do know is that it will be linked to gold. So it will be a gold, basically a gold-backed currency. How will that work? Gold will be the intermediary asset between each BRICS member. When one has a surplus against the other, the intermediary will be gold. So, what are we seeing? China has a gold facility in Hong Kong, a Shanghai Gold Exchange vault is being built in Saudi Arabia or has been completed, I'm not sure which. And there is a, Saudi has, I think, around a 20 billion surplus trade with China at the moment. That is being secured against gold on the Shanghai Gold Exchange. But when that vault is completed in Saudi Arabia, if it's not already completed, it's that trade surplus is held in the form of gold in Saudi Arabia. And I think this is this is what's going to happen with your major BRICS countries. Each will have Shanghai Gold Exchange vault in their own country. So, what will investors prefer? A gold-backed currency or a Bitcoin-backed currency? What is a Bitcoin? It's an imaginary asset, has no real assets. Stablecoin. What's a stablecoin? Stablecoin is backed by a US Treasury note. So it's backed by debt. So, in my simple language, you've got a real asset versus a debt instrument. So why are central banks buying so much gold? I think the we're starting to see a good correction in the gold price, which gets the weak players out to lay the solid foundations for the next move up. How far is that correction going to go? Probably to 3,500, and on some of our work, even down to 3,000. But that's when the next big move is.
Simon, have you heard any timelines on how these BRICS gold vaults, when they're going to be, let's say, completed? Because I've heard that, this was 2.5 years out, then it was moved to 24 months, and now it could be as soon as 18 months out until this network seems, relatively operational.
I don't know. I don't have an exact figure, but 18 months fits our scenario. Say 2 years, where are we now? 2025, 2026, 2 years, 2028. Makes sense.
So we've heard a little bit about this meeting between Trump and Xi, and it seems like there's two very different stories here. And just to continue on with what you were just saying, what are the main goals of China's 5-year plan at this point? Is it, is this the move with the BRICS? Is this the main effort of this, just trying to move away from the US and deal solely within the BRICS as trading partners and as consumers of their goods, commodities, things like that?
Big question. The fundamental, my take on the real outcome, excuse me, of the 5-year plan is preparation for continuous conflict with America. Once that conflict is overcome, that there will be fiscal and monetary stimulus enough to push China's growth rate up to between 4 and 4.5% a year, which will lead to China becoming not a developing country, but a developed nation. But in the immediate future, the policy is to create social and economic stability. It's stability, not stimulation. That has huge consequences. The other big thrust is to become self-sufficient. Self-sufficiency means not just dependent upon China's internal resources, but also those of the BRICS member countries, which are growing in total. America, I think, is trying to create bottlenecks in some of China's supply chains China needs to import copper concentrates to service its huge smelting, copper smelting and refining industry. So if you take a lot of China's copper is now coming from the DRC, and it's notable that in the last year, America has negotiated with the president of the DRC deals so that American companies have first refusal on any new mining projects. And there was very recently a DRC promotional campaign in Washington. Come and invest in our country. Is that just stage one? Will they then try and go after China's assets in the DRC? I don't know, but given the power play that is going on, I think that's quite a reasonable assumption to make. Will it succeed? China for years has been not just taking equity stakes in copper operations in the DRC and Zambia, but has also been creating the important infrastructure to service them. So whoever runs the DRC, that can quite probably be moving chairs, will have a difficult decision to make because China has invested long term, not just in Zambia and the DRC, but across Africa. Russia has been doing the same. You see some of the Russian commentaries on RT News, how African voices are saying, we don't want to go back to the colonial empire. We want this new world, the multilateral one. So there's a big PR campaign going on both sides. So Africa is becoming, you could almost say, the next potential flashpoint between the American-led world and the BRICS-led world. Just as we know that for donkey's years, Washington has been trying to dismember Russia, break it up into smaller units, and then able to control, to take control of Russia's huge natural resources, agriculture, as well as minerals. So I, coming back to where you started the question, the Trump-Xi meeting, my take is from the Chinese side, which is that we, and excuse the pun, trumped the American president. And in particular, over rare earths and magnets, what China said, we will pause from further introducing new export controls, leaving the existing export controls unchanged. What does this mean? It means that America and other G7 countries will have to operate by using existing stocks of rare earths until they are exhausted, which will be in a matter of only a few months. So, and the American side was, their view was quite different.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, Simon. It seems like we get two very different stories. I read through your recent article, and it says that China is not going to impose any further restrictions at this point on the rare earths. And yet I've seen news reports from the West that say that it was a successful negotiation and we're back to normal on the rare earth exports.
It's
So,
not right. I'm sorry.
well, and that's exactly what I
I did check what I thought was the actual conclusion with informed friends in China. And there was an immediate answer. You are right. That is the correct interpretation.
Well, and you and I were talking again today before we hit record here, and I heard a story. There's a particular podcast that is kind of like short form news podcast, and I tuned into it today just to see what was going on in the world. And according to this podcast, and I'm just repeating what I heard, that Russia's economy is on the brink of systemic collapse because the sanctions are actually, having the intended effect. So how do you what is the information that you see out of Russia?
Well, let's start. I believe you said that that podcast was done by an ex-CIA analyst. Well, another ex-CIA analyst, Larry Johnson, has been in Moscow for a couple of weeks talking to a wide range of people. And he said, all these rumors about Russian economy falling apart are completely untrue. And then he went through his analysis as why. A couple of months ago, I did a big report on China, on Russia's economy, which was based on what my Russian friends gave me, a very, very detailed breakdown of the economy. And what I drew from what they sent me was as follows. The military side of the economy accounts for about 36% of GDP. It's growing at over 8%. The rest of the economy is struggling at around 1 to 1.5% growth, because the central bank is in a fighting mode against inflation. So they bumped interest rates up to, I think it was 22%. And now that inflation is falling, so are bank rates falling down to about 17%, and will continue to fall as inflation declines, meaning that the private, the non-military part of the economy, excuse me, will start rising. Sanctions did Russia a lot of good. It meant from being dependent on imports, they are now becoming self-sufficient, same as China. So sanctions are not going to work. Trump has is whether he has or will impose sanctions on any country that buys Russian oil. Well, that's not going to work simply because BRICS are not going to listen to him. There was a statement I saw out of India from their major refinery company. Oh, we are continuing to buy Russian oil. No way is China going to stop buying Russian oil and gas. They've invested billions in this new pipeline, which crosses Mongolia into China. So Washington can threaten, but it ain't going to work.
The reason I wanted to bring that up is just to highlight the differences of this, let's say the information that the West seems to put out versus, the East seems to put out. And this meeting with Trump and Xi seemed very positive. And I wanted to ask you if these agreements that came out of it are durable, but it doesn't seem like the reality of the situation is that there were, any real agreements that did come out of it.
Well, I've spoken about rare earths. On soybeans, what happened was that Brazil hiked their soybean price from around 5.30 a ton to 6.80 a ton before the meeting, as part of a deal with America for America to cancel the tariffs on. So that was an internal deal. And in order to give Trump something, China agreed to buy soybeans. But the next trick is they negotiated a discount from the market price of 10%. And my guess is that in the contracts, for whatever duration are the contracts, that is embedded in the contract. And then if you look at what the Chinese currency, excuse me, has risen against the US dollar in the last 6 months or so, that is 2.3% appreciation. So you combine the two, and China comes out with a very good deal. Yeah, Trump has satisfied his farmers, but China's done a good commercial deal.
The other piece of that was the semiconductors. Do you think that Trump made any concessions for China, like on these high-tech chips and semiconductors that need to go back in?
That is a super question, because from what my guess is that China won't accept any NVIDIA or other foreign American chips and semiconductors to be sold into China. Because the Chinese leadership does not want their own industry to be dependent on America, particularly in the tech sector. And from reports that I have seen, within a matter of 2 to 3 years, China will be on a par with America's technology. So it doesn't matter if Trump lifts those export controls, because China just won't buy them. That's my take. But it fits the general view in China. We must be self-sufficient in the tech sector. Where China differs from America is that China has evolved the artificial intelligence-driven robots into very practical use, so that increasingly across manufacturing, humanoids are running factories, not human beings. That's already the case. So just think of it. You have already a manufacturing sector in China that is far produces high quality goods at very competitive prices. Add in this new technology, and it's going to make them unbeatable. Again, it comes back to Washington versus Beijing. Washington understands this. Are they going to allow China to become so dominant? So whatever, if there is a period of relaxation between the two countries, it's only for a short period.
Simon, as we consider China's 5-year plan again, and this idea of self-reliance and also just increasing the interdependence or interconnectivity between the BRICS nations, how do you see the role of US debt on the Chinese books at this point? And is that going to be just continually rolled off as it suits them? Or, is it a more acute type of situation that they'll roll it off in, do you think?
My take is that they will continue to roll off their US debt holdings in a gentle way. But if push comes to shove between the two countries, they will dump.
Because they have that ability or that lever to be able to hurt the US financial system in that way.
But I think that's only when push comes to shove.
Right. How durable do you think Xi's leadership is right now?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask that question. I will be honest in saying that I get two opposite schools of thought. both of which have very strong connections and know China very well. So my conclusion is that yes, there has been friction within the leadership because she was pursuing a very personalized form of leadership, which included making personal policy changes. And that has now been resolved into a collective leadership. So that before policies are made, it's agreed within the top. On the other hand, looking at it from the pessimistic side, she remains in office for the next 2 years. Not all the decisions will be his. I think the power play, the real power play, has been between the PLA or the PLA Commission and the government. But I suspect that it will end up by being a storm in a teacup. She will remain in office, and it's a collective decision-making procedure.
Simon, trying to get some perspective on everything we've talked about today. If we consider that we're headed for some flavor of global recession, what do you think are the important steps to take to protect yourself and your finances in that, let's say, for that next 8 to 10 years?
You need enough cash for day-to-day living. You need your assets not to be held in paper, but in physical gold and precious metals, preferably held outside the banking system. You need to Food prices are going to soar for all sorts of reasons, including climate. So you need to see if you don't have a garden which you can convert into a vegetable plot, you need to see that your deep freeze is stocked full all the time. Food prices are already rising, and by the second half of next year will be rising rapidly. Already, the FAO food price index is up year on year. The last time I looked, it's 7%. Yeah. And this is only the start. So basically, prepare yourself for very volatile times ahead. The past is not going to resemble the future. We're at that pivotal point in history.
Do you think that gold and silver are really the only assets that survive this type of crash and transport some value from whatever, like the current system, to whatever the system that precedes it.
In my view, they are the preferred assets. I mean, people talk about copper, but I don't buy that. Copper is part of the economy. No, it's for me, it's the precious metals.
Simon, is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about or to consider before we wrap up here today?
I keep coming back, the big picture, which is a unilateral world versus a multilateral world, and how is that going to play out? All of these little regional wars, throat skirmishes, are part of that bigger picture. It ain't going to end tomorrow.
Well, no, Simon, that's a morbid thought to end on, but I think a heavy dose of
Realistic,
reality.
if I may add.
That's what I was going to say. A heavy dose of reality is important in these times, and
Yeah.
understanding what we're looking at and taking a little bit of action is are the most important steps to be able to somewhat weather this storm if we can.
You weather it by, as I said, having enough cash to live day to day on, securing your assets in precious metals held outside the banking system, and keep your deep freezes full of food, or convert a garden into a vegetable plot.
For anybody that wants to read more of Simon's work, it's all available at simon-hunt.com. And of course, the SHSS Substack at shss.substack.com. Simon, thank you so much for your time today. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you too. I enjoyed the chat, despite it was 6 o'clock when we started. AM, not PM.
6 a.m. for you so that you can make your tennis lesson, and 8 p.m. for me. That's how we make it work. Always
Well done,
appreciate it.
and thanks for making it work.
Thank you, sir.